Joining us for our Newsmaker conversation this week is Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has been at NIH since 1968 and has been the director of NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. He's just returned from a multi-nation tour with Secretary Leavitt on the whole subject of avian flu. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Let me start with the first question before our two reporters join in. What should the American public understand from the recent, it seems, flurry of activity of White House meetings, multi-nation trips, stories from the U.S. and from Britain and Asia about the current level of threat of avian flu?
Well, I think what this reflects, this activity, is a need and a concern about being prepared for a worst-case scenario. When you think in terms of the possibility of a pandemic flu, there's a broad spectrum of the possibility of whether it will come, and if so, to what degree it's going to be really serious. And we have that from experience in the 20th century when you had the 1918 flu, which was a public health catastrophe of 50 million plus people worldwide died. Then you have the 1968 pandemic flu, which was really relatively mild, not significantly greater than the seasonal flu. So when you have what's going on in Southeast Asia, namely the chicken pox infected, et cetera, and people getting infected, although inefficiently, there's now a total of 118 cases, there's still the potential for there being a very serious public health catastrophe. So the flurry of activity is the concern and the preparedness efforts about aiming at how can you respond to the worst case scenario. So I think that's what you're seeing right now.
But are there clues for this year in particular, since the possibility of the flu and a pandemic has been a long-running scenario?
Sure. For example, if you look at the normal timing in the evolution of viruses, there were three pandemics in the 20th century. We haven't had one for 37 years. So notwithstanding what's going on in Southeast Asia, you would say we're about due for the natural evolution of how pandemics occur. So that in and of itself is something you need to keep an eye on. Then you superimpose upon that the fact that you're having in an unprecedented way literally many countries where there are tens and tens of millions of chickens that have been infected, and also importantly the virus has evolved to be able to jump from chicken to human still very, very inefficiently. So it's not something where it easily does that, and they have been real rare, like one or two cases that have been definitively confirmed that it goes human to human. So it still is a virus that has not been able to assume the capability of becoming a real classical pandemic. But when you see this smoldering activity going on, the migratory birds, then it's not just Southeast Asia, it's Russia, Kazakhstan, now we're talking about Romania and Turkey. So the bird flu, the infections of the birds, they're not going away. So the conditions that would be amenable to a pandemic are not resolving themselves. In fact, they're getting worse. So that is also a reason for the accelerated current activity.
Two reporters at the table to join us in the questioning of Dr. Fauci. Ron Hutchison, White House reporter for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Before joining the national staff for Knight Ridders, he was based in Washington for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and has covered both Texas and presidential politics for more than two decades. Steve Sternberg has been USA Today's medical reporter since 1998. He's been covering medicine and related issues for major newspapers, including the Miami Herald and Atlanta Journal-Constitution, for more than two decades. His freelance work has appeared in The Post here in Washington, Mother Jones, Medical Economics, Science, The Scientist, and Science News. Gentlemen, thanks for being here. Ron, why don't we start with you for questions?
Well, Dr. Fauci, I think the question most Americans have is probably the one that's most difficult to answer. How scared should people be about this?
Yeah, as you said, Ron, it's almost impossible to answer that question. We should be concerned, but the concern should be an impetus for preparedness and not an impetus for fear or for panic and thinking that the end of the world is coming. And it's an understandable reaction when the American public sees the flurry of activity that Susan was referring to. They immediately interpret that with the inevitability that there's going to be a catastrophe, and that's not the case. In fact, if you look at it in the big picture, it's unlikely that we're going to have a pandemic flu that's going to essentially roar through the population of the world and cause a 1918. But the possibility exists, likely a small possibility. So as I was mentioning before, that spurs us to prepare for the worst case scenario. And when the American public sees you preparing for the worst case scenario, sometimes they assume that the worst case scenario is inevitable, and it's not. So we should say, stay tuned, monitor and follow what's going on. It's a serious situation, but it's not anything for people to be frightened about.
But that raises another question. If we're planning for the worst case scenario, isn't it possible that we're planning and spending money that we don't have on something that's not going to happen?
That is a possibility and a reality you just have to face, and the balance and priority of things. If you plan for the worst case scenario and it doesn't come, people will naturally say, well, then you wasted money. But if you don't plan for the worst case scenario when it comes, then you've been grossly negligent and irresponsible. It's a tough call. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fauci, where does the United States stand in relation to other countries in terms of preparedness?
Well, I think that no country is well prepared. We have a very large country. So if you have a country with, 10, 15, 20 million people, then to make vaccine for 50% of the population is much easier than to have a vaccine for 295 or so million people. I would say that we're as prepared or better prepared than any other country, but that doesn't mean that we're well prepared right now. We're taking a balanced approach. I think sometimes you read about that people will and countries will equate the amount of Tamiflu they have in their stockpile with preparedness. That's just not the case. It's a much broader, more comprehensive approach to preparedness. Vaccine, Tamiflu, public health measures, surveillance capabilities, things like that.
And Tamiflu is a drug. Can it actually prevent the flu if you take it before you become infected?
Tamiflu is a drug that has been used for some time now for what we call seasonal flu, the flu that we get, every winter on a very predictable basis. If you get sick and you treat it with Tamiflu, you can decrease the number of days of symptoms of the standard seasonal flu. It can also be used as what we call a prophylaxis or a prevention, so that if people are exposed, for example, in nursing homes to the flu and you're really concerned about them getting infected, you can give a daily capsule for an individual during the period of time of the incubation period for that exposure, and you can be pretty effective in preventing. But when you then extrapolate that to what it would take to essentially cover the whole country, you're talking about an almost impossible number of capsules of Tamiflu.
And aren't there some questions about its effectiveness with H5N1, or whether it would remain effective?
Well, there are two issues. That's a good question. There are two issues with regard to the effectiveness of Tamiflu. One is if the microbe, the virus in question, is sensitive to it. So let's assume it's sensitive. We have experience, clinical experience, about the fact that Tamiflu can lessen the sick days or lessen the duration of symptoms with a standard seasonal flu. We don't have any really good controlled experience of how Tamiflu is going to work with a pandemic H5N1. We'll assume that it will work, and I think that's a reasonable assumption that it will work. And that's the reason why people are talking about stockpiling it. One of the concerns we always have with any antimicrobial, be it an antibiotic or an antiviral, is that microbes can evolve resistance to it. And we already know that this H5N1 is resistant to one of the classes of antivirals, the ranitidine amantadine class. It still is sensitive to Tamiflu, and we hope we never have to use it for H5N1. But if we do, we hope that it remains sensitive to that particular drug.
Dr. Fauci, what makes this virus so scary? Why is this scarier than the garden variety?
It gets to what a pandemic is. There are two issues. There's the issue of what the population in general's background capability to respond to a virus. Each year, we get infected or exposed to the most common viral strain, which is H3N2. So whether or not we get vaccinated, it's a good idea to get vaccinated, but whether or not we do or we don't, each year you get exposed to this H3N2. So when a different version of the H3N2 comes along next year or the year after, your body's pretty much experienced. You may not be particularly specifically protected against that, but you're not going to have a broad range of diseases with people really getting seriously ill, except for the relatively small numbers each year. With H5N1, the human species has never before been exposed to H5N1. So there's no background protection so that if you get exposed, you get kind of a booster response. That's the first thing. The second thing, it's extremely virulent thus far in how it's evolved. Of the 118 people who've been infected, documented, 61 have died. Now, if it assumes the capability of going from human to human in a rapid, efficient manner, it will likely, as most viruses do, become less virulent, namely be less deadly. But right now, it's killing 50% of a small number of people, the 117, 118 people.
How does that compare with other viruses?
Well, other again, you've got to compare with viruses that spread rapidly from person to person. When you spread rapidly from person to person, you generally are not particularly deadly, with some few exceptions. For example, smallpox will kill 15 to 20% of the people that get infected. And smallpox is rapidly spread in close contact from person to person. I think what you need to do to get a kind of a big picture feel of the potential of this is that in 1918, which was the real catastrophe of public health, where 50 million people died worldwide, the mortality rate was only about 2 to 3%, 2.5%. And yet very, very many people died. The reason is that so many people got infected.
Isn't it likely, though, that in this case it's not really a 50% mortality, because
no.
We don't know about
right.
cases we don't know about?
Exactly. And what needs to be done is what we call serosurveillance. And when we went over to Southeast Asia and we were talking to our counterparts there, we stressed, and they understand, they didn't need us to tell us that, to get a feel for the range and the scope of this particular virus, you need to know how many people, what proportion of people, have actually been exposed and didn't get sick. Because what they're looking at are only the people that get brought to the attention of the authorities. The reason why we think that there isn't a lot of what we call subclinical infection, because when you look at the people who are exposed to the people who are infected and sick, there's not a lot of infection or disease. Very, very rarely do we see that. So mm-hmm. that indicates that it likely is not doing that. But you don't know until you look. One of the critical things we need to do is do these serosurveillances to see the prevalence.
What is the, excuse me, what is the Asia connection with these dangerous flus?
Well, the Asia connection is that the circumstances, the socioeconomic, agricultural circumstances in Asia are very amenable to having viruses evolve from an animal species to the human. Influenza is fundamentally a bird. It's most commonly a bird virus. It's seen in ducks, it's seen in chickens, it's seen in seagulls. It also is seen in pigs. So if you just think for a moment from an agricultural standpoint, what countries have chickens, ducks, pigs, and human beings living in very, very, very close quarters? When we went over there this past week and we looked around, we saw the conditions that we had read about. You see people whose livelihood is by raising chickens and selling chickens locally or in the market, and they're sleeping here, the chickens are running here, the ducks are near the chickens, they're all together in the markets and in the backyards and free ranging. So the conditions of living and the agricultural conditions there are really much different than other countries that you would see. So it's a very common situation to see influenza, which is fundamentally a bird type of a virus, evolve from Southeast Asia. If you look historically at the viruses as they've arrived, the Hong Kong, China, Southeast Asia connection is predominant. Not exclusive, but predominant.
And how confident are you after this trip that this has the attention and serious attention of the governments of those countries?
Well, it absolutely has the serious attention of the leaders of the government and of the government in question. One of the issues that they face that's a problem for them is that although they may be committed to what we call surveillance and transparency, namely look around to see if you get cases, and when you do, be public about it. Don't try and sweep it under the rug, because then things get worse. We believe they're committed to that. The problem they have is that they're very decentralized. So you have all of these provinces where people have authority and they raise the chickens, and even the individual farmers may not be so amenable to letting anybody know that their chickens are sick. In fact, we've seen situations there where people have told us stories that people will buy sick chickens, kill them, and eat them because they're cheaper when they get sick, as opposed to saying, wow, we have a real problem here. Let's stay away from this. It's ingrained in the culture of some of those countries, and it's very difficult to change and say that the livelihood that you make or the thing that you've traditionally done for so many decades, if not centuries, you just got to put that off for a bit. That's very difficult, even for the leaders of the country.
Just a detailed question. In most of these countries that we're talking about, are the governments committed to helping the farmers when they
yes.
come in with these eradication and culling programs, taking away the livelihood of these small farmers you're talking about? Are the governments replacing the monies for these people?
The answer is yes and no. Some are, and almost none have the capability of giving them a price for it that they would normally get at the market. So even the countries that have the good intention and some better resources than others, it is very difficult from a financial standpoint for them to absolutely recompense them for every single penny that they would have lost.
Sure, so there's a disincentive
to report. Absolutely there's a disincentive to report.
You mentioned people eating infected birds. I think that could be a concern for a lot of
yeah.
Americans as well. Is there any concern that, from eating either an
no.
infected chicken or the eggs?
No, actually, if you cook the chicken, it's pretty clear if it's well cooked that it isn't transmissible. When I say eating the chickens, I mean they take them home, they butcher them right there in their kitchen or wherever it is, and they're plucking the feathers off, and all of that virus is there. It isn't actually the eating of it if it's well cooked.
And what about a raw egg?
It's something you'd want to stay away from. That there isn't well documented that, but I would think if you have eggs that are from chickens, there's contamination all over the place. See, it isn't just the chicken secretions or the chicken feces, but when you go into these places, and that's really one of the good reasons of going there, you actually see things that when you read about it, it doesn't register, but when you see it, it's people traipsing in from the chicken droppings in the backyard into the house, washing your hands. You always hear public health people like myself and others talking about washing your hands. They're there playing with the chickens. They may have chicken droppings on their hand. They pick up an egg, bring the egg inside, you know, open the egg, and then all of a sudden, is the egg really contaminated from within? Maybe not, but the entire area there can be contaminated when chickens are infected.
The wild markets in Asia are real
eye-openers.
Incubator. Yeah, well, tell us about it.
Yeah.
What did you see there?
Well, we went to some live markets, wet markets, they call them, actually. And we saw just what you've been seeing in the media that go over there and report back in various magazines and others, that people are there and there's a lot of chickens all bunched into a cage or what have you, and they come out and they just cut them right there and bleed them out, and you see ducks. There's one custom there that has actually been outlawed in certain countries because of the fact that it's clear that it can spread the virus, is when you kill and slaughter a duck, you take the blood, bleed it out into a container, and you get blood pudding, which is a very important delicacy in certain countries in Southeast Asia. So you may have blood from an infected animal that you actually consume raw. I couldn't think of a worse way of getting this thing spread than that. And that's now in certain segments been outlawed to even do that.
What is the reaction of the folks in these countries, the farmers, to a delegation from the United States? We haven't seen this variety of flu in the Western Hemisphere yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of concern. We don't want it to come here. And yet, here are some folks in the middle of this, grappling with this. And we sort of walk in looking for ways to protect ourselves, and there's only a limited amount that we can do for them.
Right.
What sort of reaction did you
Well, you know, the reaction is actually positive, because the way they look at it, and certainly when you talk to this multiple levels, you talk to the leaders, and then we did, Secretary Leavitt did actually get in the trenches and talk to some of the people. I don't think that there's any resentment about we're going there because we're worried about ourselves. The mantra under which we went there is that a problem in a single country is a problem for everyone. So we're really in this together. So it's sort of relating to them that we're all in this. This is truly an example of a global problem. I mean, when you talk about we live in a global community, this underscores that like nothing else. And they receive us more in a way of the more you learn about it, the more you can do something about it. We're trying to get a good surveillance system, which would be very good for them as well as for the rest of the world. So I detected a considerable degree of cooperation and willingness to collaborate. Secretary Leavitt was really excellent in how he interrelated not only with the leaders of the country, but actually going out into the bush areas.
Could you talk a little bit about human-to-human transmission? The experts say, well, the cases that we know about all involve really close human contact, say parent and child. But I don't find that very comforting. I mean, if there's evidence of human-to-human transmission in a close contact case, then that mean we could have human-to-human transmission in other cases?
What it's saying, the way viruses evolve, that the only recorded rare cases of human-to-human transmission is when there was very, very close contact, like the Thai mother and aunt last year who went to the hospital to take care of the 11-year-old daughter who was infected clearly from a chicken, and they were actually holding the child as she was in the last days of her life. You don't get infection thus far with anything other than that close kind of contact. So what that really tells us is that the virus as it evolves, it's unusual for a virus, a chicken virus, to actually jump species. So it's what we call very inefficient. So it may make a single jump. And then it's even more difficult for it to make the next jump from human to human. It's going to take a considerable amount of evolution for it to genetically, either by mutations or by re-exchanging or reassorting genes with a more efficient virus, for it to get to the point where it very, very efficiently goes from person to person. So the fact that you're seeing it, it tells me that it is very inefficient. Mm-hmm. It doesn't ever have to get efficient. And I think that gets back to one of the first questions you asked, is how worried should we be that this is going to happen? It's really very unpredictable, unlikely that it's going to all of a sudden emerge into an extremely efficient spreader like you see with the seasonal flu. Because remember, the H3N2, which is the predominant circulating influenza in seasonal flu, has over years and years adapted itself to be very efficient, to the point where you go in an elevator or in a metro, you sneeze on somebody and three or four people get infected. This is on the other end of the spectrum. It's really very inefficient in going from human to human.
May I pick up on a different topic, which is the decoding of the 1918 flu pandemic virus. It was hailed by people in your profession as a major breakthrough in understanding the potential for pandemics this time around. Let me take it from the other aspect. Sure. Considering that flu was notable in the amount of death it caused and the fact that healthy people, young people in the population were struck by it and killed in enormous numbers, doesn't it, the publication of the decoding on the internet for people who might want to do harm to Western societies, worry you?
Well, you know, we in the scientific community take that seriously. It's not something that we consider trivial. But there's always the consideration of the balance between the benefit of broadly getting the scientific community with all its scientific talent and interest involved in working on this problem that would come up with a much greater good balanced against what people who would have nefarious motives would do with it. You know, generally, if people have nefarious motives, they're going to get that information anyway, because, quite frankly, the techniques that were described in those recently published papers are not new. The sequence of 5 out of 8 of the genes were already known and published. One of the papers did the decoding or sequencing of the other 3 genes, and the paper that appeared in the journal Science using a molecular technique that's known, reverse genetics, was able to essentially reassemble molecularly the virus so that all of the 8 genes were functioning. Now, you're right, that could be a way for someone to do that and do it in a nefarious way, but that's the kind of information that people who are sophisticated enough to be able to do that can wind up getting that information anyway. But all the good then of getting the scientists with expertise in influenza for using that to be able to figure out the pathogenicity, how you block it, new drug targets, information on what you need to follow to see it as it evolves to be more efficient. For example, we were able to show, we the scientific community, not me, that this in fact was a pure bird flu. because the thought was maybe it reassorted, and that's the reason why it was able to go efficiently from human to human. What it tells us that by pure mutations alone, that virus ultimately was able to efficiently spread. So now when we monitor these other potentially pandemic flus, we at least have a benchmark to look at what might happen as it gets closer and closer to doing what we don't want it to do.
And do we draw from that the more likely threat in this case is straight up jumping reassortment?
Actually, Ron, I don't think we can say that. I think it can be either, it can be no way, which we hope, or it can be either way, namely just strictly mutate and stay a pure bird virus, or have what we call reassortment, where you get the same person or the same animal get infected with an efficient spreader and the pandemic bad news strain. They go together, they exchange genes, and you get the worst of all possible worlds, something that can spread easy but has the virulence of the H5N1, and that's the concern we have. But we can't predict what's more likely for it to evolve, if at all.
Now, this bad news strain, the 1918 bad news strain, is one of the background strains that's circulating commonly now,
right,
isn't it? Aren't we much more accustomed to...
We are. Well, in 1918, it was a pandemic because it was an H1N1, and we had never experienced an H1N1. The same way as in 1957, it was an H2N2, and in 1968, it was an H3N2. You're right. There is a background degree of exposure to and likely protection to H1N1. You wouldn't want to count on that to make you completely protected from a 1918 type strain, but we certainly have experience as a species against the H1N1. In addition, this particular 1918 strain is sensitive to the available antivirals, both Tamiflu and Ramantadine.
You know, if I could just follow off, we've seen a lot, and you know, it seems that every time you tune into the news, there's some new virus making the jump.
Right.
We've had, you know, West Nile. We've recently had SARS. And I'm wondering what lessons we've learned from these other experiences of these outbreaks.
Well, the lesson we learned, I don't know if you want to quote it a lesson, is the fact that we live in a very tenuous balance with microbes. And we talk all the time about emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. They're going to occur to a certain degree anyway, but there are certain things that we, the human species, do to make it more likely to have that jump. If you encroach, for example, on a particular environment in which these microbes exist, common practices dating back to slaughtering chimpanzees to eat them, which is very likely the way the HIV/AIDS virus jumped into the human species, going into rainforests where there are viruses there and encroaching on the environment, or even social behaviors, the sexual revolution behavior among gay men early on that allowed a virus like HIV to take its seed in this country. So there are things that we do to the environment that makes that inevitable jumping from one species to another occur.
I guess the magic bullet in this case is a vaccine. Which doesn't exist.
Right. Well, it does. It's just we don't have enough of it.
That's a good. Yeah. I mean, how can you have a vaccine against a virus that we haven't, that hasn't right. really developed yet?
Yeah.
So how do you know it's effective?
Well, we have
What's the outlook?
You couldn't use the word effective because effective means you've challenged it in the field and it protects against infection. What we have now is an H5N1 that was isolated from a Vietnamese patient. A vaccine was made. It was tested and is continued to be tested even as we speak, first in healthy adults, and it was shown that it induces an immune response that you would predict would be protective against that H5N1. So we're pursuing the vaccine development. The sobering news is that it takes a much higher dose of that vaccine to elicit an immune response that would be comparable to the immune response that we do with the standard seasonal flu. So the issue is how you produce enough. So what we'll have to do is continue monitor how this virus evolves. And if it evolves, we hope it never does, but if it evolves to the point of becoming very efficient in going from human to human, you're going to want to take a look at that and see how different it is from the one that you have a vaccine for. If it's very similar, then the vaccine virus will probably cross-react enough to give you some protection. If it's significantly different, you might want to take that isolate and plug it into the vaccine production capability and go after it and make that be your reference strain.
Before we leave vaccines, when you do internet searches and find discussion areas on this, one of the criticisms of the United States government that you read is that we have allowed our vaccine manufacturing to be outsourced and that most of the major production is done outside of the United States, leaving the country vulnerable.
Not only outside the United States, but even if you factor in the ability of outside companies to do it, the entire, and we've been talking about this for a very long time, the entire vaccine industry is very fragile. The influenza vaccine production industry is even more fragile, if not broke. And one of the major reasons for that is the economic disincentives for any companies to get involved in vaccine development, because we don't look upon vaccines as something that we're willing to pay a large enough price for. The vaccine industry is inconsistent. Just take influenza. It's seasonal. It's a risky business to make. People don't take it seriously that they really all need to get vaccinated. The process of making it is somewhat antiquated. So if I were a drug company and I were an executive saying, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to invest a few hundred million dollars to get involved in the vaccine, influenza vaccine manufacturing, or do I want to try and make a blockbuster drug that people are going to use every day of their lives all the time and it's going to cost a lot of money? You just look at the math and you say that's the reason. So what we have to do right now, which is happening very intensively, is to try and create incentives for companies to actually get involved in investing in that risk of making an influenza vaccine.
How quickly do you think we could get a vaccine ready and the kind of numbers we'd need if we had an outbreak?
Well, again, if we get around this dose problem, that the dose that's required is much higher, but let's assume that we either get an adjuvant that allows us to get a reasonably small dose that would work. Assuming that, the goal is to be able to have in place a vaccine production capability or infrastructure so that at the time we see that virus and say, this is the one that's going to get us, because this is really very efficiently spreading from person to person, to get that virus, make a reference seed virus for the vaccine, and within a period of 6 months to have enough vaccine to vaccinate everybody. That's the ultimate goal, to just have that capacity ready to go. The thing that's difficult for people to understand, understandably so, is that you're not going to ever be able to say, okay, this is the virus, you give it to a company and say, get some vaccine, and a week and a half later, it's just not going to happen. It's going to take months in the best of circumstances.
But look at the panic even last year with the shortened availability of vaccines and the garden variety flu.
Right.
As a public health official, imagine the scenario when it has been identified as this killer virus, and it takes that long to get vaccine to market.
No, it's going to be a very tough situation. I mean, if you just, as you mentioned, if you look at what happened last year, and not just last year, but the years before, there was a perception of there being a shortage. So everybody got online, they see the pictures on television of people online, and they say, oh my God, we're not going to be able to get any. And at the end of the year, we didn't use all of the vaccine that we had, even with the shortage. So there's a lot of psychological back and forth of perception by the general public about what's a risk, what's not the risk, when to get vaccinated. We've got to clarify that a bit more, I think.
You know, just to ask another question about perception, public, I think, or many people remember the swine flu outbreak in 1976, I think it was.
Yes, it was.
It
wasn't an outbreak.
It wasn't an outbreak. The absence of an outbreak in 1976.
Outbreak, right.
And I mean, people were very scared. Vaccine makers just rushed into production of vaccine, which turned out to have some serious side effects.
Right.
And as I understand it, that's one of the reasons why a lot of manufacturers are reluctant to touch flu vaccine today. How do we deal with this concern that maybe we're raising expectations too high, that maybe this won't materialize?
Right. Well, we hope it doesn't materialize, first of all. But I think you've touched, Steve, on a couple of issues. One is the reluctance of vaccine manufacturers to get involved, and all the manufacturers that we have spoken to make it very clear that they're not going to get involved in this unless there's liability protection, if not indemnification for them. So that's very clear. That's an issue that really does need to be addressed. The issue that you say about repeating a 1976 scenario is that what happened in 76 is that there was a single case from Fort Dix in New Jersey of a soldier who got infected, who got very, very ill. And what happened is that the trigger was pulled about vaccinating people before we saw, we the public health community, that this was actually a threat that was materializing. It wasn't. So maybe it was the right thing to do. Clearly, retrospectively, it wasn't because of the Guillain-Barré issue, that, you know, the Guillain-Barré being the complication that occurred from the vaccination. But currently, the strategy is that we're looking for a triggering event. So even if we had 100 million doses of H5N1 right now, and there wasn't efficient human-to-human spread, it is extremely unlikely that we would preemptively vaccinate anybody until we saw what we're calling a triggering event, which is sustained, efficient transmissibility, to say this is a threat, as opposed to going in and preemptively vaccinating a lot of people.
Wasn't Fort Dix one of the locations of the 1918 flu? Is that what?
No, that was the big one. Was the picture you see of the soldiers was in Kansas.
Kansas.
Yeah.
You mentioned liability protection being a critical part of this ingredient with the manufacturers. Does the administration plan to ask Congress for legislation that would protect manufacturers?
Well, I can't say the mechanism that the administration is going to use, but I can say that certainly the administration is very aware of the need to do something with regard to liability and indemnification. That's fully on their radar screen.
How prepared are we? I mean, if we saw human-to-human transmission in a big way right now, we'd be in a world of hurt, right?
We'd be in big hurt right now.
How long do you think it'll take us to be where we're at a place where you say, okay, we're ready for it?
You know, it really depends on how the past. That's a very good question with some historical implications to it, Ron. And it really depends on how this scenario that you're putting forth rolls out. In the 1918 pandemic, we had a couple of waves. We had an initial wave that then went down, and another initial wave came about. The second wave was even worse, clearly worse than the first wave. So if in fact it evolves and we have human-to-human transmissibility in an efficient manner, you're really just going to have to rely on good public health measures. Identification, isolation, public health mechanism, keeping kids out of school, don't go in crowded places, you know, theaters, et cetera, maybe even some quarantine, though that doesn't usually work very well when you're dealing with a rapidly spreading virus like influenza. And then utilization of the limited amount of Tamiflu and vaccine that you would have. But what it might give us some room to do is to then we know what the virus looks like. That is going to be the rapid spreader, then marshal all your resources to as quickly as possible, make as much vaccine as you possibly can. And even though you're in the middle of a, quote, first wave maybe of a pandemic, to vaccinate as many people as you can, because then you may spare them for what might be the second wave. Now, obviously, we don't have any idea whether there's going to be a first and second wave, but if it follows the model of 1918, you may have a second chance to really rev up.
And in that first wave, wouldn't it make sense to take those limited antivirals and vaccines and ship them, if the outbreak's in Southeast Asia, for example?
Yeah.
And can you, as a U.S. government official, tell Americans, well, we're not going to give you this limited vaccine because we're shipping it off to Asia?
No, we're not. There'll never be a situation where you give away all the vaccine or Tamiflu or drug that you have. But what the United States will very likely do, and Secretary Leavitt has mentioned that publicly on the trip, that we will participate in international efforts for regional containment. Exactly how that will be done needs to be worked out, but the United States is amenable to and willing to participate as a member of the global community in those efforts.
With the public still assessing what happened with the response to Katrina, which was a single event, how much confidence can the American public have in the government's ability to respond to a scenario that's a rolling disaster such as
this? Well, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult. A pandemic in its full-blown form it's going to be, as we said, a very, very difficult situation if it happened right now. So, you know, sometimes we feel that you can completely avoid and completely counter disasters, and sometimes you just can't, no matter how well prepared you are, or in a situation that's even worse, when just by the reality of the situation we're in now with not enough vaccine and not enough drug, that we are not prepared. So as Ron just mentioned in a question, if it happens tomorrow in its full-blown form, we're in a big hurt.
We have about 5 minutes left, gentlemen.
I wonder if that did happen, if flu popped up in Cincinnati or Fort Worth, would you focus resources on that region, yeah, or would you go for a national response?
First of all, you would trigger a national public health response, certainly of getting people prepared, aware, and all the things you can do from a public health standpoint. But if you saw an area, city, a town, or what have you in the United States, you certainly would try a containment response strategy, which is try and marshal in a concentrated way the resources there to contain it. Now, having said that, it's very important for the American public to appreciate that the effectiveness of that strategy depends greatly on the level of efficiency of spreading from person to person. Because it isn't like the virus was going to go from really inefficient the way it is now to overnight just spreading like wildfire. Now, if it evolves and spreads relatively inefficiently, but more efficiently than it has now in Southeast Asia, the greater chance you have of a containment within a town or a city or what have you. But once it gets to the point where it spreads reasonably well, given our transportation systems in this country, how people get on airplanes, it's going to be very, very difficult. So we have to admit as health officials that regional containment should be attempted, but the chances of success of that with a highly efficient virus is very low. It could be more successful if the virus sort of wimps along a bit in its transmissibility before it really assumes the capability of doing it very efficiently. And that's a scenario that, first of all, you hope you never have that, but if it does evolve, you hope it evolves really slowly to give you the chance to do that.
In that sort of scenario, could you see, say, shutting down the local airport or closing off rail traffic?
I think you have to keep everything on the table in the sense of a circumstances. When the horse is out of the barn and it's all over, shutting things down is not going to help a lot. But in that initial period of time, particularly if it's a slow evolver, I think any and all public health measures need to be on the table and available for state, federal, and local public health officials to utilize.
But it sounds like if you had to bet, if we have a pandemic, you would expect it to be more like a 68 than a 1918 pandemic.
I would hope it would be. I mean, if you look at the odds are that it's not going to be the overwhelming one. But you can't go on odds when you're trying to prepare a nation. As a responsible nation, you have to prepare for the worst case scenario, even though if you were to say, okay, take a bet, what do you think it's going to be? Is it going to be another 1918? Well, the chances are it's not even going to happen this year. But we need to prepare this year, and if it does, the chances are it's not going to be a 1918. But it's not a zero chance, and that's where you get the balance between you're preparing for something and the perception of the public thinking inevitably it's going to happen. I think that's what we're going through right now, is a bit of a concern and a confusion. They're getting all exercised about this. Does that mean that it's absolutely going to happen? No, not at all.
The response that you describe, it crosses the entirety of the federal government. Right. Virtually every federal agency might have a role in a response, right, to the pandemic. When will the public know about the level of coordination and planning that's
really quite soon? That's something that's under very, very active discussion right now. And I think the public quite soon is going to hear about not only the public health preparedness plan, but the broader plan.
Thank you very much for being with us. As we close here, I might tell our audience who's interested, Secretary Leavitt, who led the trip, will be on the Washington Journal to continue the conversation and take telephone calls on Monday. Dr. Fauci, thanks again. We'll say goodbye to you at this point and appreciate your information.
You.
We're going to take a quick break.
Tomorrow, Washington Journal devotes the entire program to avian flu. the government and international response to a possible pandemic, and stockpiling flu vaccines, with Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, Health and Human Services Secretary Michael Levitt, and Jeffrey Levy from Trust for America's Health. Washington Journal, live at 7 a.m. Eastern on C-SPAN. This week, the House is expected to give final approval to the recommendations of the Base Closure Commission. Also, a bill overhauling the government-sponsored Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And later in the week, a proposal for $50 billion in spending cuts in mandatory programs such as Medicaid, food stamps, and student loans. The House begins its week with a pro forma session tomorrow at noon Eastern. Legislative work begins Tuesday. The House is live on C-SPAN. The Senate is back at 2 p.m. Eastern tomorrow to continue debate on the $604 billion spending bill for the Departments of Labor, Health and Human Services, and Education. It's the largest annual appropriations bill, and it includes mandatory and discretionary spending. The U.S. Senate is live on C-SPAN 2.
We've just finished a conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH. He's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which puts him at the forefront of the administration and the government's plan for the avian flu. At the table with me, Ron Hutchison, White House reporter for Knight Ridder Newspapers, and Steve Sternberg, USA Today's medical reporter. Okay, gentlemen, what did you learn from the conversation?
Well, a pretty candid admission that the government is not ready to deal with this right now, which I don't think comes as a surprise to anyone, but to hear the head of the NIH say that is a little bit sobering. Encouraging at the one hand, when you recognize you got a problem, presumably they're going to fix it. But there's a lot to do. It's a huge issue with so many facets to it.
Steve Sternberg?
I think it's clear that the government has had some experience in dealing with outbreaks like this. I mean, we've dealt with SARS, we've dealt with West Nile virus, you know, even anthrax. And my sense is that there's a level of candor, if not confidence, about the risks we face and what we need to do to prepare.
Well, picking up on that, even the president is talking about bird flu. In his recent White House news conference that he had, I remember him answering a question and describing the possibility of the military being involved in mm-hmm. the quarantining situation. What, for you who follows the White House so closely, what are you taking away from their attempts to communicate with the public?
Well, you know, one of the things that really got the president engaged in this issue is he read the book about the 1918 pandemic over the summer when he was down in Crawford. And anybody who reads that book has got to get the message that this is kind of scary to deal with. But I also think, and Dr. Fauci touched on it as well, Katrina was a big lesson. It was a catastrophe, and this is a viral hurricane, in effect. You can kind of see one's coming. A pandemic wouldn't surprise anyone, but nobody knows how severe it's going to be, just like a hurricane, Category 1, Category 5. And I think they also learned from that communication is key. So I think especially after Katrina, the administration was eager to show that they're aware of the issue and they're working on it. And that dovetailed with the president's own personal interest in it. And it was obvious when he did a visit to the UN recently, and he met with the president of China. And with translations, those meetings don't last very long as a practical matter. And afterwards, his advisors were saying he spent a good bit of time talking about avian flu, which was another sign that it's really at the top of the president's agenda.
And what about the team that he has assembled for this? Again, because the team that responded to the hurricane was criticized. Do you think there's any revisiting the structure of who's in charge and what their experience levels would be?
Well, part of it is the issue is different. This is not hurricane relief. It's a medical community issue in a lot of ways, so you're seeing HHS and NIH involved at the center of it. But Department of Homeland Security is part of it, too, and I think they've all gotten the message. And in fact, Michael Chertoff, the director of Homeland Security, has taken some criticism for being out of Washington when the hurricane hit. Well, the reason he was is he was down at a avian flu conference in Atlanta, which may have been an indication of the priorities there as well. But there is some overlap in the personnel. But I think everybody got the message from Katrina that you better be doing a better job and you better be communicating what you are doing.
From the medical side, your beat, Steve, So much of this really depends on identification in local hospitals around the country and response and communication system. Do you know any more about how what kind of structures are in place at that level?
Well, we have gaps. The government relies on a system of what they call sentinel physicians around the country. There are several dozen doctors out there who report cases of flu-like respiratory illness. Well, that covers just about every illness you can think of. And so what they really need to do once they begin to identify these cases is confirm who genuinely has the flu and who doesn't. And there's a process for that, and those cases are reported to CDC, and they track cases throughout the flu season. But it's not an airtight network of detection and response. And I think there's a lot of discussion now about how to improve that surveillance system. The other issue is, you're dealing with folks who are going to walk into emergency rooms with flu-like illness, and there are going to be doctors and nurses who are going to greet them. And if you remember from SARS, the medical community was hit, pretty hard by that infection. And so there's a lot of concern about how to deal with a flu pandemic on that level. And I think one of the issues that we're awaiting resolution on from the government is, how are you going to parcel out these doses of vaccine and these doses of antivirals? I mean, do you give them to the first responders? Do you give them to folks in emergency rooms? Do you give them to people in the community? Do you give them to the drivers who are driving the trucks, who are delivering your groceries to the grocery store?
Do you give them to the troops in Iraq? That was one of the things in the 1918 flu. It, totally debilitated the armies over there in Europe because they came down with the flu. And there's some thought that it stopped a German advance at a key moment because they were all sick with the flu.
But a more recent example of decision-making on that level was the anthrax.
Right.
Scares of a couple of years ago. And there was criticism of the way that the decisions were made about how to hand out the antidote for anthrax.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can see what a challenge it is. In the anthrax case, you're handing out an antibiotic which had, very unpleasant side effects. And there are people complaining that they didn't have access to the antibiotic, and then there are people complaining that they were unnecessarily being given an antibiotic that made them feel terrible. And it's a really hard line to walk. I mean, how do you prepare a country of 280 some million people against something like this? And it's a category. As Ron said, it could be Category 1, it could be Category 5, but it's not going to be a geographically confined hurricane. This is something that could spread from coast to coast.
When we talked about the vaccinations and also Tamiflu, which is an antiviral drug, is that correct? We talked about manufacture and the patenting process. It's not the patenting process. And that's where I wanted to follow up on the story this week with Roche Pharmaceuticals, and which holds the patent to Tamiflu. How essential is it that they are willing to share in some capacity while still making money the prescription for that drug?
Well, this is a really interesting issue because it's one where healthcare intersects with trade policy. And we've seen it in HIV as well. The HIV activists are saying, look, there are people dying. You have companies that hold patents on these, incredibly effective drugs. And so why can't you, in essence, seize these patents and begin to produce these drugs and, in huge quantities to treat lots of people? And there are trade agreements in place that allows that in public health emergencies. We don't have a public health emergency yet in connection with this pandemic flu. And governments are incredibly reluctant to breach, patent protection because you wind up with drug companies that don't want to develop new drugs and vaccine makers that don't want to make new vaccines because where's the profit in it? So it's a touchy issue.
Doomsayers in the worst case scenario speculate that one of the first things that would happen is governments would nationalize their manufacturers to serve their own people first, which is a scary possibility.
But makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, that's their first priority is
right.
Their own public.
Right.
Yeah. I still keep ticking off in my head as you're talking the department after department of the government that has some role in a response to this. What do you envision with the president, who frankly has had some political challenges of late with regard to taking the bull by the horns on this particular issue and coming forth with a plan?
Truthfully, I'm not optimistic, and partly because it's such a mammoth task, and it's also, and we didn't discuss it with Dr. Fauci, but it's expensive. I mean, the only one of the things we've seen recently is in the Senate, they tacked on another $4 billion for Tamiflu. And the experts said, you know, somebody told me that's like trying to fill Lake Superior with a garden hose. That, you know, you got billions more to do it. Well, it's a hard thing to do, to spend billions on a worst-case scenario that may never happen. I mean, that's why the levees in New Orleans weren't built to hold back Category 5s. We could have done that, but it's that kind of decision that Americans make every day of their lives, that, you know, how much life insurance do you buy and that kind of thing. You get the long-term disability insurance. And we're at a place right now where it's hard for the country to make the kind of expenditures that we need to make to really guard against something that may not happen. And then just the mechanics of doing it. I mean, it's not only every level of government down to the local levels, the issues that Steve raised about hospitals becoming overwhelmed, that's a big concern, that you need to have some kind of surge capacity. There's something like 100,000 ventilators in the country right now, and during the average flu season, something like 85% of them get used up. What do we do if we have a pandemic with lots of pneumonia?
But the plan is one that seems like it would also be useful for response to a terrorist attack. So it sort of, make one, get two for the same price in terms of disaster planning.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what the plan says. I mean, there was a lot of talk after the anthrax attacks that we were gonna build up the public health infrastructure, and Operation BioShield would provide all kinds of antivirals and vaccines. And what we saw then was really a fairly focused effort on potential terror threats, biological terror threats. And, you know, we'd like to think that this huge investment of funding would generate some cross benefits. We'll just have to wait and see.
Sure. And at the same time, with all this candor that you've both talked about, we are also tipping off our enemies that we're really not very prepared to respond to any kind of virator situation.
Fortunately, you know, it's not easy to mount a bioterror attack. You know, we saw it happen with anthrax, and I think everybody was surprised. There was a tularemia scare recently. It's not impossible, but there are other things that are a lot easier.
And with that 1918 virus, for example, I sure wouldn't want to mess with that, with the goal of spreading it to another country.
Yeah. Because those who tried to spread it would get it
themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah,
right.
Which is a safeguard, certainly. Yeah. So because of the multifaceted nature of the story, what's next for you in your line of pursuit of inquiry as a reporter?
Well, I think we spend a lot of time trying to explain this to people. I mean, you know, my job very often is to translate what the experts are saying. I spend a lot of time talking to people like Dr. Fauci about what they're up to. And, you know, to another degree, you're trying to see the shape of the response. As you know, you're trying to figure out what the shape of the response will be and how effective that will be. We do a lot of analysis of, you know, well, we say we're gonna ramp up vaccine production, but can we? Will the companies cooperate? What are the political pressures at play here? How will it play out?
And same question for you.
Well, for me, the next big thing on the president's agenda is the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Korea, which will bring together leaders all along the Pacific Rim. And he'll be going to China. So he'll be kind of in ground zero looking at this issue, and I know it'll be on the agenda there. Because the other thing we didn't talk about are, aside from the illness and the human toll, the economic toll of something like this. It could really have a big impact on commerce. I know recently a bunch of financial institutions in New York, Deutsche Bank sponsored a meeting for them on this, where they looked at this issue. So certainly it's something on my beat covering the White House, I'll be looking at what the president's doing to kind of make sure that we're getting the surveillance and the cooperation we need across the world.
Thanks to both of you for being here, helping through your questions, people to understand this issue more. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.